Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hey guys, welcome back to Storytime Slayer Podcast. I am your host, Haley Lira. Thank you so much for joining me. Today we're going to do part 2 of the John Smith's awful, horrendous crime. Where we left off last time was we learned all about his first wife, Betty, and her disappearance. And while looking for her, we discovered that John once had a wife named Janice Hartman. So we're going to pick up where we left off and discuss who Janice Hartman is. And we're going to kind of dive into who John Smith is, how they met, and just kind of everything leading up to the crime. Dun, dun, dun. Of course, if you haven't already, I would totally appreciate an awesome review. And go check out my Facebook, Storytime Slayer. Remember, that's where I post all the photos, videos, anything pertaining to the case. And let's just jump in. So, who is Janice Hartman? Well, John didn't really divulge a lot of information about her. The way he told it was they were young, they had a really short marriage, and then she kind of went her way, he went his. It really wasn't a big deal. But it's always the little things that get you caught up, huh? The little lies and little truths. So Dee and Sherry knew that the couple got married in Detroit, talking about John and Janice. It was one of the very few details John would divulge. So the women decided, you know what? Let's find her. And they started to cold call every Hartman in the Michigan phone book. They went with Michigan because, remember, he said that they got married in Detroit. So they assumed maybe she was from the Michigan area. No luck. So then they thought, okay, well, let's try Ohio. John's girlfriend said that he was from Ohio. Maybe Janice was from Ohio as well. So, you know, the daughter and the sister, they start cold calling every Hartman in the Ohio phone book. And as luck would have it, you know, I like to say when the stars aligned, a man named Gary Hartman answered. And he did have a sister named Janice. And she had, in fact, been married to a John Smith in the late 60s and divorced in the early 70s. But when they asked how they could get in touch with Janice, a bomb dropped, you guys. Gary said that they couldn't because Janice had been missing since shortly after her and John got divorced. She just vanished. And Janice's family always felt like John was responsible for her disappearance. Of course, Betty's daughter and sister immediately called Detective Dansbury in New Jersey. He was the one over Betty's case. And Dansbury called a detective in Ohio to find out everything he could about Janice Hartman and her missing person case. So we're going to backtrack to the late 60s, and I'm going to tell you everything that I know about John and Janice. Janice and John had met at a party when they were 19. John had grown up with his grandparents and brother in Seville, Ohio. He'd never ever had a girlfriend before. He was rather awkward and geeky, but he was surprisingly outgoing for how geeky he was. Janice was really sweet and bubbly, but she could be a tad rough around the edges, probably because she grew up on a farm with two brothers. Just like John, Janice hadn't really dated either. They were both goody two-shoes growing up, but Janice did begin to get a little wild hair in her late teens around the time that she met John. After high school, Janice went to flight attendant school in Missouri, and the two kept in touch over letters. Then on a whim, Janice and John ran off and got eloped without telling anybody. Her mother actually filed a missing person report when it happened because Janice just up and disappeared without telling anybody that she was even going on a trip, let alone getting married. Janice's mother made it very clear that she never liked John. She said, quote, he was a bullshitter who liked to hear himself talk, end quote. John's grandparents and mom were equally upset about the marriage, and they didn't really like Janice. I'm not sure why, but John was literally kicked out and asked to collect all of his belongings from his grandparents as soon as they found out. So after John and Janice got married, they moved to an apartment in Columbus, Ohio. No one in Janice's close circle of friends or family actually knew John that well, just what Janice told them about him, which is really weird because that's exactly how the situation was for Betty's friends and family. According to Janice's mom, despite what good things Janice said about John, there was obvious tension in the marriage, and John totally lost his cool a couple times in front of Janice's family. So, for example, Janice's family had a get-together, and John was playing a game of chess with either her brother or brother-in-law, and he lost. Well, when he lost, he actually threw the chessboard across the room and then demanded that him and Janice leave the family gathering immediately. This is the sort of tantrum John would throw. John would, of course, go above and beyond to make up for it with gifts and affection, like most physical and emotional abusers do. Despite his gifts, things never got better between John and Janice. They actually got worse, and the fights turned physical. Janice would fight John back, though, so things got really nasty. And Janice told her mom that John threatened he would kill her if she left him, so her mom encouraged her to leave as soon as possible. July of 1974, John and Janice agreed to a divorce. August, the papers were submitted, and Janice moved out. So first, Janice moved into her mom's, but her mom was too strict, and so she ultimately decided to move to her dad's house. After a short time, John moved into a mobile home park, which is a trailer park, about 15 minutes from Janice's dad's home where she was living. As time passed, John started to spy on Janice, and then he would just randomly pop up at places she was. So restaurants, stores, even her house. I do want to mention that this was 1974, so there was no real way to get in touch with someone besides calling their landline over and over or lingering around places they frequent. So yes, I do think that John is weird. Absolutely. I just want to clarify that this behavior was a little bit less alarming given the time period, and maybe that's why Janice kind of accepted it. So this actually worked, and Janice would casually hang out with John from time to time. I think John's entire intention was to rekindle his relationship with Janice, but she did not want to get back into a relationship with John. So she would actually go hang out sometimes with other guys. She started partying like a rock star, and I think this infuriated John. Plus, a lot of people know now, which I don't think they knew then, the most dangerous time for somebody in an abusive relationship is when they leave. So what I'm about to tell you may sound irrelevant, but I promise it is very much relevant. Like I said, Janice started to party hard. And on November 9th of 1949, into the wee hours of November 10th, Janice went out with a guy named Leonard. I don't know if that's his real name. They may have used a fake name, but she goes out with this guy. We'll call him L. And at about 2 a.m., they decided to go to a house party. Several men were at this house party. In fact, I did not hear of any other women being mentioned at the party. And one of the guys there tells Janice that he wants her to dance. She loved to dance, but she really didn't want to dance when he asked her to. The guy told her that he'd pay her, but she still declined. And her excuse was that there just wasn't room because there was a table in the way. So the guy moved the table. Unsure what to do, Janice starts dancing, and someone told her to take off her shirt. They said that if she did, all the men would strip naked. Okay, first of all, what kind of deal is that? Like, I'm not going to show anybody my titties in exchange for a glance at their balls. Have you seen balls? This is an awful exchange. Janice was a bit freaked out. She did take off her sweater, but she still had on like a little shirt underneath it, and she did not remove any more clothes. She danced to two songs, and then she sat down with her date, L. He sounds like a real gentleman. Then Janice was attacked. One man grabbed her and began forcefully removing her clothes, but she wiggled loose from his grip, only to be grabbed by two other men and carted off to a waterbed in another room at the house. The group of men attempted to restrain and gang rape her. However, she fought for her life. She wiggled, she squirmed, she bit, she scratched, she did everything to make it impossible for them to penetrate her. One guy did violate her with his hand, and while she was struggling during that assault, another one of the men grabbed a shotgun and pointed it at her. But that's when a guy in the group felt things had escalated too far, so he ended the whole assault. He reasoned with the group that they could not kill her, and he immediately returned her clothes to her and allowed her to leave. So when Janice left, it was technically early Sunday morning. She went straight into the police station and reported what happened. She wanted to press criminal charges. After she reported the attack to police, she went to see a doctor for birth control and sleeping pills. Obviously, she was experiencing significant trauma. So fast forward to November 18th or 19th. It's about 10 days following her attack. Janice was supposed to go to a court hearing in regards to the charges that she'd pressed, but she never showed up to court. And her mom got a call that Janice had missed the court proceedings. So her mom immediately knew something was seriously wrong. There was no way she was going to miss that court hearing. I just want to touch base on the situation with Janice being a known party girl in a small town. I've been there, I've done that, got the trophy. Now, when she reported that attempted gang rape and didn't show up for court, a lot of people were under the impression that she was a party girl who'd kind of brought this attack onto herself, and they didn't think a lot of it. But when Janice's mom got the call Janice didn't show up for court, she was very concerned, and she called to tell John. And John was the least bit concerned about Janice not showing up to court. And he told her mom that he heard her car was abandoned on a road headed towards Columbus, Ohio, with the doors open. And that's all he knew about the situation. After talking to Janice's mom about her disappearance, John decided to call the police from his trailer and report his wife missing. That's right. Even though he and Janice were divorced and she didn't even live with him, when John reported her missing, he lied to the police and told him that they were married and living together. And the last time he saw Janice was November 17th, 1974. He claims that he, Janice, and a male friend of Janice's went to a bar called the Sun Valley. He said Janice's friend was stocky and had a mustache, but John had no idea what his name was. Either Janice or her stocky friend were supposed to meet up with a man at 10 p.m., but John left, and he left Janice at the bar with the stocky guy. From there, John has no idea what Janice did. Unfortunately, the police didn't do a super deep dive on Janice's disappearance, and they just kind of took John's word for it and moved on. As far as evidence, there was no evidence of foul play because police never searched anything. They didn't look in John's trailer. They didn't look in his car. They didn't look in Janice's car. The disappearance of Janice was just a total head scratcher. Yeah, and when I say they didn't look in Janice's car, because just like Betty left her car at home, Janice left her car in front of John's trailer as well. And with her reported attack, missed court date, and mysterious stranger that her ex-husband placed her with, the police didn't even really have anywhere to go from there. Then March 7th, 1975, Janice's mom made another report because she hadn't heard from Janice since she disappeared. She told police that she thought John did it and said, quote, "Since the divorce, John felt like if he couldn't have her, no one can," end quote. So it should be alarming to police that John lied about even being married and living with Janice and had no explanation for why her car was there. But all they really did was ask around a little bit, and they still never bothered to search anything or like really dig deep. They did question John's sister-in-law, who was married to John's brother, and she told the police that there was no way John would hurt Janice, that he loved her too much, and suggested Janice was hiding out at her brother's house in Florida. I'm betting this is where John got the idea to start telling people that Janice ran away to Florida. He probably, when his sister-in-law suggested it, he was probably like, oh my God, that's such a good idea. So Janice's case went cold. No reports were ever made following March of 1974. Now let's fast forward back to 1991. After gathering all of this information, Detective Potts in Ohio reopened Janice's missing person case, and he worked with Detective Dansbury in New Jersey, who was member over Betty's disappearance case. So they decided this could not all be coincidence. It was apparent that John had done this before and gotten away with it. First things first is that law enforcement tracked down Janice and John's friends and family for interviews. So they start doing this at the tail end of 1991, beginning of 1992. John's family was immediately a dead end. At first, John's brother Michael agreed to speak with police when they came to him. And it was really interesting because when they told Michael that John's wife was missing, Michael said he was really disappointed to hear that because Sheila was such a nice person. But when they corrected Michael and clarified it wasn't Sheila, it was his wife Betty Fran, Michael was really confused because he did not know who that was. And as soon as the police started to get somewhere with Michael, his grandma busted in and basically told Michael to shut the fuck up. And he obeyed his grandma, and the police couldn't really get anything else from him. Now, they tracked down one of Janice's friends, and she said that she remembered nothing about Janice meeting some stocky guy at a bar or anything that John had told them. Throughout the years, John told people a number of stories about what happened to his first wife. He told a girl that he was dating in the summer of 1975 that his first wife caused a lot of problems. She hung out with a rough crowd and started using drugs, so their relationship fizzled out. Now, as far as what happened to Janice, John told his girlfriend that shortly after Janice disappeared, he got a phone call late one night from a stranger, and the stranger told John to drive out to a very specific roadway, kind of on the outskirts of town, back roads. And John did what the caller said, and when he got to where they told him to go, he actually found Janice. She was deceased. Her body was bloody and bruised. And John said that he always thought it was a sex thing gone wrong and specified that she had semen around her anus. So John then removed her wedding band and engagement ring before he fled the scene. His reason for not calling police is because he said he was afraid the anonymous caller would murder him. Okay. And he actually showed his then girlfriend Janice's rings. For some reason, the girlfriend never reported it and they never talked about it ever again. This is also a story that John never shared with the police. So it did freak out the girlfriend and the relationship ended a short time later. You know the old rules, hear something, say something. So, it's spring of 1992, and the detectives did not have a lot to go on, but it was enough for a search warrant. So, on April 2nd, they decided to execute a search warrant of John's condo, car, and office. Now, remember when John reported Betty missing? He told police he had no photos of Betty because she was so camera shy. Well, the first thing investigators notice when they go into John's office is a large framed photo of Betty. In John's office, they also found a suitcase that had over a dozen photos of Betty, $900 cash in large bills, and the two keys to John's car. Remember the ones that he claimed they'd lost? Back at the condo, they found everything Dee and Sherry said that would be there, all of Betty's things. Who leaves all their stuff? Who leaves with none of their stuff? After the search, John agreed to go to the police department and have a chat. He did not request or obtain a lawyer. John was grilled for 12 hours and did not crack once. He came up with a story for anything that the police asked. Whether it made sense or not, he was cool, calm, and collected. His excuses and inconsistencies didn't always make sense, but he just stood by it like a nut job. They asked John about the disappearance of his first wife, and he said he didn't know. Her car had been found abandoned. Which they knew was a lie. Her car was parked in front of his trailer when Janice went missing, just like Betty's. When pressed about Betty's disappearance, John maintained his versions of events and actually began to paint himself as a victim of emotional abuse. By the end of 1992, the police have a lot of inconsistencies, but no hard evidence against John, which is very frustrating to know someone's lying, but you can't prove it. So the next best thing they could do is try to locate the bodies. Maybe there were possible Jane Doe cases. First, investigators sent DNA teletypes to every police department, and it turned up jack shit. Nothing. So next, they sent letters to every police department. And when that didn't turn up anything, they sent letters to every coroner in Ohio outlining dates and descriptions of Betty and Janice, along with their suspicion of John Smith's involvement in the women's disappearance and deaths. Unfortunately, none of that got any hits. So Dee and Sherry got creative and they spoke to every news and media outlet that would listen and post their story. Ohio and New Jersey outlets were going wild for the story. John was labeled a sociopath. He was ridiculed at work and he actually had to quit his job in 1993, which he moved back to his empty Connecticut home because Sheila, his longtime girlfriend, left him. Eventually in 1994, John moved back to Ohio to help with his lucrative family real estate business. And let's be honest, who else is going to hire this motherfucker? Time goes by and police could not drum up anything new. However, in May 1997, all that changed. John was in a car wreck and he gave police someone else's social security number. The social security number belonged to a stripper that lived in Florida who was actually from Connecticut. Weird. But this did give detectives an excuse to question John again. And like before, he came without a lawyer and he was completely cool, calm, and collected. And guess what? After a 10-hour interrogation, he didn't crack. All police could do is wait for a break in the case. Okay, so next I'm going to tell you the good part where the universe intervened. Robert Hilland was a man from New Jersey. He served on the police department for 8 years before he joined the FBI and moved to New York. So he'd been friends with Detective Dansbury. That is the detective in charge of Betty's case. So Robert Hilland just went to pop in on his old friend and he saw the John Smith file on a shelf in Dansbury's office. He'd always been really curious about the case and asked where he was at with it. And when Hilland heard that the case was going cold, he thought maybe he could get the FBI involved. Of course, this was an amazing opportunity to involve the FBI and reopen the case. It wasn't easy, but Hilland was actually able to get his superiors on board. Once the FBI got involved, they basically started the entire case from scratch and got everyone who'd ever investigated the case over the years in a room to talk about John. The plan was to re-interview everybody and begin surveillance on John. They strategized that they would interview John and anyone who was closely related to him or friends with him all at the same time on the same day so that nobody could tip each other off or intervene from anybody else speaking with police. And that day was set for May 5th, 1999. Since the police had last had tabs on John when he got arrested for using somebody else's social security number, he'd since moved to Southern California and worked at La Forza Automobiles. It's a company that customized luxury Italian cars. John was 47 at the time, and he'd even remarried. Wife number three was a woman named Diane. And just like Sheila and Fran, they'd met at work. At first, she wasn't interested. She thought John was unattractive, but he was so persistent. She eventually agreed to go on a date, and the rest was history. September 5th, 1998, 3 months into dating, they were married. Diane does admit later that she married John for his money. She was tired of living paycheck to paycheck, and she really didn't know much about him or his past. John told her that he was a widower and that Betty, his wife, died of cancer. A lot of the investigation's focus was placed on John's brother Michael because he was the only relative willing to talk all those years ago, and they thought maybe there was something there. Okay, so let's get to the juicy interviews. At first, John was really cool, calm, and collected. Same stories, same white lies as before, nothing different. Until they broke the news to John that they recorded a conversation he had with his longtime girlfriend, Sheila. And in the conversation with Sheila, John admitted to her that he lied to the police, but he didn't admit what he lied about. So when the police brought this up in their interview to John, it provoked an emotional response from him, which they had never seen before. First, he shrieked like a girl. He was coming unglued. So the police pressed him harder and he began crying and said, quote, "I'm tired of lying. I don't want to lie anymore," end quote. Then he asked for Tylenol and said that his head hurt. There was a couch nearby, so John went and lied down on it, and he just kept crying. And he literally laid there crying for like 20 minutes before he started complaining of chest pains. Ugh. So the police had no choice but to cut their interview short and take him to the hospital. While that was transpiring, his brother Michael was being interviewed, and Michael just cracked, y'all. It was too much for him to bear. Michael admits that the last night Janice was seen alive, Michael had dropped his brother John off at the Sun Valley Lounge bar. Now, Michael wasn't sure if Janice was there with anybody or anything about that story of Janice and the stocky man. And he says he doesn't know anything about the disappearance, and that's kind of where Michael ended his conversation. So this whole thing was very frustrating, and it felt like it was going nowhere again. May 6, 1999, the whole FBI task force disassembles and goes home, and it was just really frustrating. But Detective Hillen stayed in Cali for an extra day just to meet with John's newest wife and tell her all about his past. See if she would open her eyes to how dangerous this man was and maybe have information that could help the police. Meanwhile, Michael could not stop thinking about his brother John and what really happened. So I'm going to tell you what really happened after Janice disappeared. Weeks following, Michael went with John to his trailer, and he said that John's trailer was a total wreck. He watched his brother John box up a bunch of clothes and stuff that belonged to Janice and had Michael help him move it all to their grandpa's garage. Now, fast forward to a couple weeks following that, everyone was at Michael and John's grandparents watching the Michigan-Ohio game, and John was nowhere to be found, so Michael went looking for him. He found his brother John in the garage making a plywood box. John was in a really touchy mood, Michael noticed, and when Michael asked what the box was for, John said it was for Janice's belongings. But it was a really awkward-shaped box. It wasn't like a chest. It was long and narrow, about 8 inches tall, 4 feet wide, and 16 inches wide. It would be 5 years before the box was ever brought up again. Michael said he went home for his lunch break, and his grandpa came inside and asked him to come with him to the garage. So Michael did, and he realized that his grandpa had pulled out the box John built 5 years ago. It was shocking and unfathomable at first, but it was Janice inside the box, and her legs had been cut off at the kneecap to fit in the box. Michael wanted to call the police immediately, but his grandpa said no because his dear wife couldn't handle it. So the grandpa and Michael nailed the box shut and put it back. Then they called John and told him that they knew what was inside the box and he had to come pick it up. John was there within hours. At the time, he was driving a little black Corvette that the box barely fit in. So to get the box to fit in there, John had to lay the passenger seat flat, and the box literally fit window to window. Before John left, Michael asked him for an explanation. And John's explanation to Michael was that two men came up to him and they either drugged him or knocked him unconscious the last night Janice was alive. He said after being knocked unconscious, he woke up in a warehouse and Janice was dead next to him on the floor. The men that kidnapped him and Janice were laughing and said that they were going to frame John for the murder. They then rendered him unconscious again, and he woke up in his trailer with Janice's lifeless body on the floor next to him. So he quickly grabbed her, put her in the car, and right as he was pulling away, police were pulling up to his house with their lights on. Wow. What an awful story. That is just a dumb story. Michael said John left with the box, and that was the end of it, and it haunted Michael ever since. So July 1999, Michael actually gave a formal statement to police of what he knew, and he agreed to work with authorities and FBI in exchange. He would be protected against criminal charges. John could feel things shifting, probably because his brother had attempted to get John to incriminate himself by, you know, recording phone calls and calling John, but it never worked. John would never crack. That's the secret, guys. That's the secret to getting away with stuff. Hide all your evidence and never, ever crack, not even to your only brother. Michael did make it clear, though, that he was going to tell police what he knew because he couldn't handle it anymore, and John just told him to do whatever he had to do. John did become frazzled. His third wife, Diane, said that on February 23rd, 1999, she and John went to dinner in separate cars because she had met him after work. And on the way home, he was following her, but then he disappeared. So after not hearing from him all weekend, she filed a missing persons report on Monday. And then noon that same day, John called her and he told her that the FBI held him up in a hotel room and roughed him up, refusing to let him make any phone calls. Diane could see then that John was a lot and he was probably guilty, but she still stood by him in public despite her suspicions. I think she was maybe afraid of what he would do given his past she was recently made aware of. It sounds like he makes his wives disappear. The last two women that wanted to leave him are literally gone. Sure enough, she did get the balls to officially separate from him in December of 1999. A short time later, she actually had to file a restraining order against him because he came to her home and tried to threaten and intimidate her and her daughter. So despite Michael's statements, police still didn't have enough evidence to like really prosecute John to the full extent that they wanted to. They really needed to find a body more than ever. This time, investigators drafted another letter about potential Jane Does matching Betty and Janice, but it was sent to every law enforcement agency in Indiana based on where John lived and worked for a very short time after Janice disappeared. So, it is February of 2000, and an Indiana officer named Berman, an officer for the Newton County Sheriff's Department in Indiana, opened one of these letters. And he said that he read it three times, and it literally took him back to 20 years ago as a young deputy sheriff. See, Berman had gotten a call from a road crew that found a plywood box with human remains on the side of a very rural road. Berman knew this has got to be the Jane Doe. This has got to be Janice. So Berman called the detective who sent out the letters and said, "Hey, I think I have Janice." The woman found in the box had her legs cut below the kneecaps. A DNA test from, I think, Janice's mother identified the remains as, yes, a positive match to Janice. Tuesday, October 3rd of 2000, John Smith was taken into custody. He didn't talk openly to police like before. This time he lawyered up. On October 11th in 2000, he went to arraignment for charges of aggravated murder and pled not guilty. Michael was probably one of the strongest witnesses for the prosecution. John was found not guilty for the charge of aggravated murder, but ultimately guilty for the lesser offense of murder. John had no reaction at his sentencing. He was sentenced 15 to life. They did try to prosecute John in the disappearance of Betty Fran, but there was not enough evidence for a grand jury to indict him in 2000. In 2002, John unsuccessfully tried to appeal his conviction. And in 2021, he was extradited to New Jersey to face charges for the disappearance of Betty Fran. In October, though, of 2022, the judge ruled jurors would not be privy to the details of his first wife's murder case, Janice. And the last thing I saw about the case is John was offered a 20-year deal to just fess up to what he did to Betty, which he denied and did not counter offer. So as of now, there isn't really anything new I can find. He will be eligible for parole in 2029. So there's a Lifetime-styled movie called Murder on Pleasant Drive about this case and a really, really good book called The Stranger in My Bed with like every detail you could possibly want. Plus lots of true crime articles and episodes cover this story. So I really enjoyed it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I just couldn't believe that a man could get away with these crimes like that. So anyway, thank you so much for tuning in, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.